Well, good afternoon. My name is Lynn Tesser. I'm a program officer here at the Institute, and I'd like to welcome everyone to the eighth in our series of project reports. And it's my great pleasure to introduce to everyone our speaker for today, Senior Fellow Stephen Ferry, who will be giving us an integrative critique of the Northern Ireland peace process. Now, Dr. Ferry, in fact, was involved in the negotiations leading up to the Good Friday Agreement. He also participated in subsequent talks with the British, Irish, and American governments leading up to the implementation of the agreement. Presently, he's, in addition to serving as a senior fellow here, he's also the General Secretary of the Alliance Party of Northern Ireland. Since 1993, he's also served as a member of Suburban Belfast's North Down Borough Council, a term of which he served as the Deputy Mayor. Dr. Ferry has also worked as a trainer and consultant on a total of four projects in Croatia and Bosnia-Herzegovina for the National Democratic Institute. He holds a PhD in Collective Security, the National Interest, and the United Nations from the Queen's University of Belfast. So we're absolutely delighted to have someone with Dr. Ferry's expertise and experience here at the Institute today to give us an update on the situation in Northern Ireland, and I think to present a really interesting critique of the Good Friday Agreement, as well as some other ideas. And at this point, I'd also like to formally thank Dr. Ferry's research assistant, Jennifer Heeg, who's, I think, still out at the table out front, who did a lot of work to make this event possible today. Just so that everyone is aware, the event will be recorded and available later in the week or early next week on the web. So you don't need to take copious notes, okay? No pressure there. So at this time, I'd like to ask everyone to turn off your cell phones and Blackberries, not merely so that we don't have extra noise, but not turning them off will interfere with the microphone system and will create more noise. So please turn them off. So with that, I think I'll turn the floor over to Dr. Ferry for about a 30 to 40 minute talk, and after that, we'll open up the floor for questions and comments.
Okay. Thank you very much, Lynn. And could I also extend a very warm welcome to everyone here this afternoon, and to those England fans, apologies for clashing with the football match. Can I also extend my thanks in particular to Lynn for all her support and guidance through this process of preparing the project report, and also to Jennifer, my research assistant, for all her help with the organisation off today. Hopefully you've all got a copy of the written report, and there's an even longer version of that report available upon request, so if you want to email me later on, I'll be happy to forward that to you. I'm also working at the moment on a special report on the current phase of negotiations in Northern Ireland, which are likely to intensify during the fall, and hopefully that will be released within the next couple of months, well in time for those to begin. In terms of what I'm presenting today, I'm really looking at what to me is a very interesting question as to how peace has essentially come at the cost of reconciliation in Northern Ireland. We have a situation where violence has essentially disappeared, but we also have problems of political polarisation, continued problems with community relations, and an assembly that's suspended and has a very uncertain future. And looking at how those, in a sense, unintended consequences of the agreement in terms of the deepening polarisation have actually contributed to that political stalemate. And I'm asking the question as to how we can actually move forward upon those new political realities. I think, first of all, it's important to acknowledge that the agreement was a major breakthrough in the history, the troubled history of Ireland, and certainly was rightly celebrated with great fanfare back in 1998. But 8 years on from the creation of the agreement, Northern Ireland remains in the grip of political uncertainty. that the British and Irish governments, who are essentially the co-sponsors of the peace process with the assistance of the American government, have determined that 2006 will be a decisive year for the process. By the 24th of November, either a power-sharing devolved government will have been restored, or the Assembly, the key institution arising out of the Good Friday Agreement, will essentially have been dissolved, and with obvious implications for the standing of the agreement. If those talks do indeed fall, the two governments will move to some ill-defined Plan B, which will try to see them implement the other aspects of the agreement and govern Northern Ireland through some type of joint direct rule. The institutions themselves were suspended back in October 2002. At that stage, the Ulster Unionist Party, who were then the largest Unionist Party, refused to sustain the institutions in response to the uncovering of an alleged IRA spy ring at the heart of the political process. Since then, those immediate causes of suspension have been addressed. With relation to the spy ring, it was actually uncovered that one of the leading persons accused of that was actually acting as a British agent and was recently found shot dead at a remote cottage in County Donegal. Beyond that, we have seen last year the IRA issuing a statement that effectively renounced the use of violence for all purposes, not just terrorist attacks upon the British or Irish states. Also, the IRA engaged in decommissioning of virtually the remainder of their weapons under international supervision. Currently, a body called the International Monitoring Commission, which I think is a very radical departure and as interesting precedence for elsewhere, are monitoring the current IRA commitment to non-violence. And while they have reported a number of outstanding issues, I'm expecting them to give the IRA a relatively clean bill of health by October 2002 when their next report is due. However, a simple restoration to the status quo before that isn't really feasible. A number of factors have to be taken into consideration. First of all, the bar that Sinn Féin and the Republican movement have to meet in terms of non-violence has actually increased quite dramatically over the past 3 or 4 years. It's no longer acceptable just to have a ceasefire that refers essentially to attacks on the state or sectarian killings of people on the other side. It's a much now wider understanding of the threat to the rule of law and democracy itself that comes from organisations previously involved in terrorism branching out into organised crime or trying to set themselves up as unofficial police forces trying to control different communities within Northern Ireland. Also, since then has been a major change in the balance of power that we saw with the 2003 Assembly elections, where the DUP became the largest Unionist Party and Sinn Féin became the largest Nationalist Party, overtaking their perceived more moderate rivals in the form of the Ulster Unionist Party and the SDLP. I would raise major question marks whether the DUP and Sinn Féin, as the two new larger parties on either side of the divide, are capable of reaching sufficient agreement to allow for the restoration of the Assembly and a power-sharing executive, let alone whether they will be able to sustain such institutions. If that doesn't come to pass, I don't think there are major causes for concern. There won't be a major return to terrorism. And Northern Ireland as a society will continue to function with a degree of normality. But the danger is that Northern Ireland becomes essentially a politically dysfunctional society, unable to sustain shared institutions. And given that the Northern Ireland situation is not one of the most extreme examples of divided societies around the world any longer, it raises interesting questions as to why that would be the case. And I think a lot of that potential intractability has to do with the fact that there are such breakers that will soften any problems or collapse of the institutions, given that both the British and Irish governments are there playing a very supportive role and will essentially continue to govern Northern Ireland. But deep down, I think that type of approach does illustrate a certain degree of complacency, because there are some deeper structural problems within Northern Ireland society that really need local decision making if they are to be addressed properly. In this paper I'm trying to explain how the implementation and the nature of the agreement have actually contributed to these deepening divisions and how they have actually led to this political deadlock. First of all, I want to look at the agreement itself. And in doing so, I want to stress that it does have many successes. And while I will naturally be focusing on many of the failures, I think it's important not to overlook the fact that in many respects it has made a huge number of positive changes, both within Northern Ireland and within the wider British Isles framework. And I don't want to ignore those. Most obviously, we have the end of terrorist violence, more clearly on the Republican side and also to a certain extent on the Loyalist side. However, that violence has been channeled instead into a lot of organised crime, which remains a problem. As a result of that, the British government have been able to normalise a lot of the security measures that had to be put in place in Northern Ireland to address the terrorist threat from both Republicans and Loyalists. So a lot of the security towers and the apparatus of associated with that have gone. Policing reform is probably the unsung success story of the agreement, where the old RUC, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, has now become the Police Service of Northern Ireland, and there's now much wider support across the community from virtually all sides, with the one exception of Sinn Féin. And I fully expect Sinn Féin to sign up to policing at some stage over the next number of months or in the next year or two. There's also been a major change in the whole atmosphere of North-South relations, and it's not just a focus of institutions being put in place to reflect the nationalist identity on the island of Ireland. There's a lot more economic and social exchange across the border, including unionists. And finally, something again that hasn't really been commented upon much, I think there has been a major change in the norms of what is deemed acceptable behaviour in terms of the language that people use. For example, there's now a much greater acceptance that people on all sides have to condemn sectarian attacks, though obviously a lot of that language remains heavily coded, and behind that you can find a lot of underlying tensions remaining. In terms of failures of the agreement, which I'm going to focus on a little more, implementation clearly was much more difficult than people anticipated. In a sense, that is to be expected in most situations, and I think we can see that from most cases around the world. In Northern Ireland, I think there was a lot of naivety at the time of the Good Friday Agreement and an acceptance that things would unfold as planned. And obviously, things have not taken place as people expected. The most visible manifestation of this is the failure of the political institutions. Over the course of the 8 years since the Good Friday Agreement, the political institutions have been in place for less than 4 years, and the longest continual period of operation was only 11 months, so they haven't even managed a full year so far. Obviously, there are different ways of looking at the agreement, glass half full versus half empty. And it's interesting to note, as an aside, that the differences between the international and internal perspectives on this. Northern Ireland is still held up around the world as being one of the success stories of conflict resolution and a model for a lot of situations elsewhere, notwithstanding the problems internally. Within Northern Ireland, by contrast, there's a lot of cynicism about the process, and people fed up with a stop-start political process, and particularly cynical of politicians who are perceived as dragging out what should be a process that being properly implemented. I'm very keen that Northern Ireland is seen in a proper balanced way, and that both the positive lessons of Northern Ireland are continuing to be learnt, but also some of the negative lessons of what went wrong in Northern Ireland and what could have been done better are actually picked up by others. In doing so, I mean, with some of my criticisms, I'm conscious that I am potentially setting the bar quite high as to what should have happened. But I don't make apologies for doing that. And in particular, I think there are issues regarding community relations and rule of on the standard of rule of law, which I think are integral for a lot of processes around the world, and that there is a tendency for the international community to come in a very superficial manner. And I think one of the lessons from Northern Ireland is the need to actually have a much deeper commitment and look a lot at these underlying societal conditions and how divided peoples are interacting with one another. In terms of specific problems, I think the central issue for me is the underlying vision for many people behind the agreement, which is one of conflict management. It was essentially assumed that Northern Ireland was going to be irrevocably divided into two opposed communities that couldn't be reconciled, and at the best that could be expected is that the divisions would be managed through some form of what has now been described as a benign apartheid. Not that apartheid was ever benign. The notion of two separate communities was firmly entrenched within public policy, though there has been a reaction against that, which I will explain later on. In terms of political theory, for the political theorists here, and I won't bore you with a lot of this, but you can ask me afterwards if you're interested, the agreement was very heavily consociational in its nature. It was very much about entrenching group identities and trying to manage those. However, I would suggest that a lot of the underlying conditions for success that consociational theory sets out aren't actually present within Northern Ireland. The most notable element of consociationalism within the agreement is the form of institutionalised sectarianism that's found in the Assembly voting system, where Assembly members are expected to register themselves, as well as with their party, with a communal designation, whether it's unionist or nationalist. And very kindly, those of us in the political centre are allowed to call ourselves other, which doesn't actually mean that much. That essentially, for me, sends out the message that that Northern Ireland is not a single society. It's, in fact, two different polities, and you have a battle for control within each, and that people aren't really being expected to look to the common interest of Northern Ireland. There's no united political system. Intra-ethnic competition is the order of the day. Also, the particular voting system really created a hostage to fortune, where if a very motivated minority would be able to hold the system to hostage. The irony of this is that the particular mechanism was put into the agreement at the behest of the Nationalist SDLP, who were very wary of what had happened before under the old Stormont regime, whenever unionists had essentially governed Northern Ireland as an ethnic democracy with under majority rule and not given any sense of power to the other side of the community. But in doing so, it really illustrates a tendency of people fighting the historical battles rather than looking to the future. What they did was actually give anti-agreement unionists the ability to hold the political institutions hostage and to frustrate things. Another aspect of the agreement that gives some cause of concern is the principle of consent. Now, this is something that's usually held up as being one of the most radical aspects of the agreement, and in many respects it is. Essentially, and I think this is almost unique around the world, both the British and Irish governments have respected the rights of the people of Northern Ireland to determine their own constitutional future, whether that's part of a United Ireland or remaining part of the United Kingdom, and that neither of those governments have a direct interest in how that decision is going to unfold. And arising out of that, now virtually all of the parties in Northern Ireland support that principle. But what we have is essentially agreement on the ground rules of settling the constitutional question. We don't have any agreements or prospective agreements on what that outcome can be. And as a consequence of that, that constitutional question will remain a major polarising factor within Northern Ireland politics, and will ensure that politics is aligned along unionist and nationalist lines, and there can't be any real coming together. I think for me, the ultimate solution is in trying to find some type of agreed constitutional framework that people from both sides of the community can accept just to some degree, rather than having what is essentially a mutually exclusive choice, winner takes all. Also, another factor of the agreement is what's called constructive ambiguity, which essentially you have one set of words where different sides to the agreement are allowed to take different interpretations of the meaning of those words, which can be a very handy way of getting parties across a particular blockage at a particular moment in time. But what it does, it stores up problems down the line whenever those issues are up for their actual implementation. At a global level, the agreement itself is seen in different ways by both unionists and nationalists. For unionists, the agreement was essentially part of securing Northern Ireland's position within the UK and granting nationalists a degree of equality within Northern Ireland in return for them accepting that Northern Ireland was remaining part of the United Kingdom. For nationalists, however, the agreement was essentially a form of a way station on the path to an eventual United Ireland. They didn't have the political numbers to have a United Ireland by democratic means, but Northern Ireland is moving ever so slowly towards what they perceive to be the eventual outcome. It's almost like a purgatory on the way to heaven situation. Also, the agreement itself has become seen in very sectarian terms, which is extremely unfortunate. Back in 1998, at the time of the agreement, it was seen as being a win for everybody. Both unionists and nationalists, those who supported the agreement, felt that it benefited the entire community more or less equally. By 2001, that situation had flipped, and everybody, according to the polling evidence, was saying that the agreement was benefiting nationalists and that unionists were losers. So from benefiting society as a whole, it had moved to a zero-sum situation within the course of 3 years. The one area of constructive ambiguity, the one specific area that's caused most difficulty, is that area of decommissioning, where this is the notion of when the IRA would formally destroy their arms and explosives. The agreement says that that all parties have a commitment to make this happen within 2 years. The Republican movement more or less took that at its literal meaning and said, well, we'll do our best, but we'll see how it goes, folks. But for everyone else, that was fairly clear that there was a specific commitment by Sinn Féin that the IRA, its armed wing, would decommission within 2 years of the agreement. And whenever that didn't become the case, that contributed a lot to the problems with the implementation. The final thing I want to say on the agreement was also the imbalances in the degree of support for the agreement across the community. In the referendum, 71% of the people of Northern Ireland said yes, which on the face of things was very encouraging. But whenever that's deconstructed, through looking at exit polls, a very disturbing picture emerges. Over 95% of nationalists said yes, but I'm convinced that at best 50% of unionists said yes, and it may be even be the case that less than 50% of unionists supported the agreement. A lot of people spun this as saying that Protestants as a whole were supporting the agreement, but it's important to make a distinction that not every Protestant in Northern Ireland would describe themselves as a political unionist. And so that situation, I think, at the outset was creating warning signs. And I think there's perhaps an interesting parallel with the situation with the Iraqi constitution, where the Sunni population didn't embrace the new constitution, whereas the Shias and the Kurds both said yes in overwhelming numbers. And it may be a factor where previously dominant groups in society have a difficulty in the transformation to a new political system, but there's obvious less implications as to how you bring those groups who feel that they have lost an historically dominant position, how you bring them along into a new dispensation. In terms of the implementation, the problems there, there's a number of issues. The implementation was largely dominated by discussions around four key issues: decommissioning of arms, the security normalisation, the British government removing the security apparatus, reform of policing structures, and also the stability of the institutions, all parties having a commitment to maintain those institutions. The specific problems I see with the implementation were, first of all, there is the default of the Republican movement and also loyalist paramilitaries over their commitments to decommissioning. Essentially decommissioning before the Good Friday Agreement talks, became decommissioning during the talks, and then became decommissioning after talks. And then the actual commitment to decommissioning after became stretched way into the distance. And so many efforts were made to try to get this decommissioning to occur that it almost sucked the life out of the peace process over the course of the past 8 years. And it was indeed only last year that the decommissioning of weapons was finally achieved. The problem was that the Republicans were able to use decommissioning or rather the potential of decommissioning to suck out more and more concessions from the process. And in return, and I think this is where the unionists made a big mistake, because they placed such a singular focus upon getting the weapons, they were almost prepared to pay any price in terms of acceding to concessions and other points of the Republican agenda. But what happened was that those concessions that had to be granted created the backlash within not just the unionist community, but also wider society, where people were very upset what they saw at the price that was actually being paid, and that accounted for a degree of the fall in support on the unionist side for the agreement. There was also the problem of continued paramilitary activity and involvement in organised crime. Essentially, at the time of the ceasefires back in 1994, the IRA and the Loyalists were able to define their ceasefires in very limited terms. A ceasefire essentially meant an end to attacks upon the British state, the security forces, and sectarian killings on the other side. But a large degree of discretion was given to paramilitaries to continue to engage in other activities, including organised crime, running mafia-type operations, and involving themselves with all sorts of other illegal activities at a community level, trying to run working-class communities. The response of the government in terms of essentially turning a blind eye to a lot of these things also created a certain degree of a backlash, and where people perceived that there was a moral vacuum in the process, that things were a little just a bit too cynical in the way some things were dismissed. I mean, there's even a notorious case where a British Secretary of State dismissed the murder, I think it was of an IRA informer by the IRA, as simply internal housekeeping. This is not really a concern to the state. It's an internal problem. After time, that position really became unsustainable for the governments. I think there was an appreciation that really, if society was to move forward on a sustainable basis, you had to have a very clear understanding of the rule of law, and that all paramilitary activity, not just sectarian killings or attacks on police officers or the British Army, all activities linked to a potential party in government undermined the concept of the rule of law and undermined democratic norms. And it's in this respect that we see the creation of the Independent Monitoring Commission back in 2004, where they were formally asked to report and comment upon this wider ambit of paramilitary activity and to recommend sanctions against political parties that were perceived as being linked to those activities. Another problem with the implementation is the lack of any real process of transitional justice. Northern Ireland's is very unusual in a post-conflict situation for not having any real comprehensive programme of transitional justice. These are the norm in virtually every other situations in some shape or form, whether it's actual formal war crimes prosecutions looking for more a traditional form of justice, or whether it's a truth and reconciliation process. There has been some piecemeal attempts to do some elements of this agenda, but it's nothing of the comprehensive nature that is required. So you have a situation where the needs of some victims are potentially going to be addressed, but for a lot of others, nothing is being done, and as time goes on, the prospect of anything being done is rapidly diminishing. And as a consequence, the whole demand for justice in itself becomes a very sectarian issue and a polarising issue, where people are using demands for truth and justice as a means for attacking the other side. There was also a problem within the negotiations and the way those were handled by both the British and Irish governments. Essentially, they were very short-term in their focus, based upon getting over the latest hurdle in the process, rather than actually having any holistic, comprehensive plan for implementation. As a consequence, they tended to focus on the parties that were perhaps holding out at that stage. But in doing so, they undermined the other players in the peace process. Certainly on the nationalist side, the inordinate focus upon Sinn Féin helped to undermine the SDLP as the more moderate nationalist voice. Another aspect is civil society. Civil society was very crucial in the actual making of the Good Friday Agreement itself. The churches, trade unions, business sectors were all pushing for the agreement to be made. However, after 1998, they essentially switched off, and they didn't keep that push for progress up, and that has allowed the situation to deteriorate to a large degree. And if anything, civil society now is actually very cynical about the process and doesn't seem to be expressing the view that the process has to continue to meet their agenda. I think it's also important to reflect upon the way that the moderate parties, the Ulster Unionists and the SDLP, actually ran the government whenever a power-sharing administration was in place. And to a large extent, I would argue that they actually blew their chance to make it a decent attempt to run Northern Ireland. The personal relationships between the leaders of those parties were extremely poor. Also, there wasn't really any sense of either of the moderate unionist or moderate nationalist party trying to understand the particular problems that each other was facing with the implementation and trying to make life easier for them. If anything, they were probably acting the opposite to that, which didn't help things. And probably most crucially, rather than actually trying to come together and to work for the common good, both the SDLP and the Ulster Unionist Party spent most of their time looking over their shoulders at their potential ethnic rivals in the form of the Democratic Unionist Party and Sinn Féin. And they were almost paralysed by the fear of these parties making electoral gains at their expense, which in fact was what in fact happened, partially because they were so paralysed. The final aspect of implementation that I want to look at is the aspect of community relations within Northern Ireland. Back in 1998, the issue as to how the two main traditions in Northern Ireland would relate to one another was given very little attention. The assumption was that they would be divided and divisions would have to be managed. Indeed, since the agreement, there have been a number of negative trends. Sectarian and racist attitudes have remained in place. There's been a persistence of very deeply ingrained patterns of segregation, in terms of, especially in terms of how people live. More peace walls, things that are actually built to keep people apart from one another, have actually been built since the ceasefires in 1994 than was the case beforehand. And there are also major economic and financial costs arising out of the duplication of a lot of delivery of goods and facilities by the government. Against that, we have some very positive trends that need to be acknowledged. There is a growing demand from a large section of society for shared facilities, including in education and housing. The workplaces is now more or less entirely integrated. And there's also a changing conception of identity. We're now almost 14% of people in Northern Ireland describe themselves in terms of other than being a unionist or a nationalist. They're breaking away from those labels. And the government have responded to a lot of this through a new process, which they call a shared future, where they've essentially moved away from this notion of conflict management and recognised that it is a failed policy. It's not able to deliver a stable Northern Ireland. And what they have said is that it's only through providing shared and integrated goods and services and facilities that really Northern Ireland can be made sustainable. And we're expecting a lot of the policy rollout of this to occur over the next few months and years. However, there's a major gap now between what the official public policy of the British government in relation to Northern Ireland at a grassroots level is and the architecture of the Good Friday Agreement, which is very much based upon managing divisions. And is even bigger disjoint between that public policy of a shared future and the politically polarised situation that has now arisen. In terms of the political polarisation, if you're looking at the written paper on page 33, I recall, you will see that the graph and the tables that illustrate the political polarisation that has occurred in Northern Ireland over the past 8 to 10 years. And you can see that the DUP and Sinn Féin have now emerged as the largest parties on both the unionist and nationalist side. Basically, to summarise, the factors that have contributed to this is the entrenched intra-ethnic competition within the agreement, the lack of proper incentives for moderation within government, the institutionalised notion of two communities, where them versus us, competition over resources and territory becomes the norm. The exploitation by ethnic entrepreneurs, where people, whenever you have this intra-ethnic competition, those on the extremes are able to accuse the moderates of sellout and betrayal, of not delivering the goods for our side of the community. Also, the professionalism of both the two parties on the relative extremes, the DUP and Sinn Féin. The various crises in the peace process, building up the hardliners as the arbiters of what happens, of whether progress occurs. And also the weakness within the Ulster Unionist Party through the internal divisions of that party, and also essentially being perceived as presiding over concessions. And then finally, there's a problem of the declining turnout, which is most acute within the more moderate sections of public opinion. I think it's most stark if you look at the agreement in 1998, where 81% of people voted came out to vote. In the assembly election, 5-6 weeks later, turnout had dropped to below 70%, and now turnout is around 60%. And within those hundreds of thousands of people, we suspect there are a lot of moderates who would, if they were casting votes, help to change the overall political climate. To formally conclude, I want to look now at the political implications of all of this. Some commentators and policymakers within all three of the governments, the British, Irish and American, dealing with the peace process, don't seem to be overly concerned about this process where the parties on the extremes have become the dominant voices. Arguments have been made that the Good Friday Agreement should really be seen as a precursor to the real deal to be done by the relative extremes at some stage in the future, maybe even this year. The supposed advantage of this process is that it binds those with the ability to undermine progress either through the ballot box in the case of the DUP or through force of violence through Sinn Féin are bound in to the process. However, I think it's important to note that this scenario runs contrary to 30 years of peacemaking efforts in Northern Ireland by the British and Irish governments. In the past, the strategy tended to be focused upon building up the moderates in the centre, trying to find some type of deal that bridged the traditional communal divide within Northern Ireland, and then building from the centre outwards to try to embrace the extremes. And where those on the extremes refused to go along with the overall political settlement, the basis would be there within public support to address that residual threat through security means alone. That was the presumption even right up until the Good Friday Agreement. And even within the Good Friday Agreement, while it is nominally inclusive, a lot of the underlying presumptions were that the moderates would be controlling the system and would try to co-opt the extremes and try to manage them. But as I pointed out, the agreement itself put in place the mechanisms where it became inevitable that the extremes would actually overhaul the moderates. Even if the extremes are moving towards the centre, or in the case of the Republican movement, have renounced the use of violence, there are major drawbacks in trying to build and sustain a government where the main basis of popular support are on the relative extremes. Go back to your history, go back to Weimar Germany, for example. The prospects of a government in which Sinn Féin and the DUP are dominant are poor. Internationally, it seems to be the case that it's difficult to base a government upon the relative extremes. Both the DUP and Sinn Féin have mutually exclusive goals. Both parties have built their electoral success upon demonising the other, and both need a sectarian-based system to mobilise their support. Both parties are used to demonising others and taking an oppositional approach to their politics rather than actually running based upon their record in office. There are fears that they can only work together on the basis of increased separation, almost a balkanisation of Northern Ireland into different spheres of control. And even given some of the new thinking in the Balkans, I think it's becoming unfair to keep using the term balkanisation to refer to others. Theoretically, I think it is possible to design structures for these parties to coexist within the same government. But really, that would just be a short-term quick fix. It wouldn't provide long-term peace and stability, never mind strong and effective government. I think the different approaches to the shifting balance of power within Northern Ireland raise major questions for international mediators regarding the question as to whether it's better to focus on the moderates or whether inevitably you have to focus upon the extremes or a bit of both. I think that question is very relevant to the current situation in the Middle East with the rise of Hamas. But in terms of Northern Ireland, I think the new efforts to build a political accommodation around the DUP and Sinn Féin have placed Northern Ireland in uncharted waters, and a lot of major questions remain as to how things will unfold on that basis. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
Well, thank you, Stephen, for such an interesting and informative talk. And I'd like to start out with just a quick question. Your talk and also the general topic reminded me of Senior Fellow Gorka Espial's project report. He, who is unfortunately couldn't be with us today because he's out of town, and his report, of course, focused on the situation in the surrounding the Basque Country, and focused very much on the role of peace organizations or civil society organizations. Mm-hmm. And your report is very much, I think, at the elite level. And I'm wondering, have these organizations played much of a role
here? Mm-hmm. Civil society played a very positive role in the run-up to the agreement, where the churches, the mainstream churches, business sectors, trade unions, voluntary sector, were all pushing for an agreement. Mm-hmm. And were making their voices very clearly known. After the agreement, they tended to opt out of the process and left it essentially to the politicians. Mm-hmm. I think also the politicians tended to monopolise the decision making over implementation and marginalised civil society. So blame here is two-way. But today, while there are some elements of civil society that are very keen to see the agreement fully implemented, there are large elements of civil society that aren't making that push. Some may believe that direct rule isn't so bad compared to the local parties trying to run things. They don't make a major distinction between that. They're pushing their own agenda with the British government as much as they're pushing their agenda with the local parties. I mean, today there isn't huge protests on the street from ordinary people demanding the restoration of devolution. If anything, public opinion is close the assembly down, stop paying the MLAs for not doing a job. I mean, these are people who have been they were elected back in 2003 and have never formally sit in the body that they were elected to, but have been drawing their salaries ever since. So there's a lot of cynicism from the ordinary people towards the structures.
I see. Thank you. Well, let's open up the floor for questions and comments. And please introduce yourself, tell us your name and your affiliation, and your question or comment. And please try to keep it relatively brief so that we can get everyone a chance to ask a question and comment. I see one hand over here. Are there any other? Okay.
John Coakley, Woodrow Wilson Center and University College Dublin. Many thanks, Stephen. This is a great overview of the agreement. And my question is a very, very general one about interpretations of the agreement and its significance.
Yeah.
So you use the metaphor of the glass being half empty and the glass half full.
Yeah.
I suggest there's another metaphor that can be used. And that's the metaphor of the glass three quarters empty and three quarters full.
Well, yes.
The difference between the two metaphors is that one is, in the one case, we're talking purely about a matter of perspective.
Yeah.
In the second, we're talking about perspective plus certain empirical matters. And I would suggest that those who see the glass as being three quarters empty are ignoring certain realities and certain very real achievements, not perhaps of the agreement specifically, but of the broader process in which it's embedded. And these are very obvious achievements since 1994.
Yeah.
The consequence, first, of expectation that the agreement would be reached in 1998, then of I suppose a sense of euphemism over the fact that the agreement had been achieved and subsequently over an expectation that it would be fully implemented or something similar would replace it. For example, an end to political violence, notwithstanding the low-level tension locally.
Yeah.
Not just, as indicated, not just by a dramatic decline in the number of deaths arising from paramilitary violence, but the appalling injuries associated with it. Socioeconomic development, very, very dramatic development in Belfast. Third point, however, is political position. So in your graph, you label this political polarisation.
Yeah.
At one level, it is political polarisation.
Yeah.
The DUP are much stronger now,
and
the Sinn Féin are much stronger now than they were 10 or 15 years ago. These are different parties to the parties that were 15 years ago. The DUP, since December 2004, has indicated that it has bought into the agreement.
Yeah.
There's an unbelievable change in that party. Sinn Féin is a completely different party. It has moved 180 degrees since its position in the early 1990s. So it seems to me that account needs to be taken of these. In some ways, the agreement is based not just on building up the centre, but on converting the so-called extremes into moderates and moderating the extremes. And it's been very successful in this. So I'd be interested in comment on that.
Sure.
If I can add a supplementary,
yep.
It has to do with the position adopted by Sinn Féin in implementation of the agreement, which you implied that they were using decommissioning as a bargaining chip.
Mm-hmm.
There again, another dreadful metaphor. I would say not so much a bargaining chip, because it's not clear what they gained.
Yeah.
A fig leaf is the metaphor I would use. A fig leaf to disguise from their own supporters the extent of concessions that have already been made.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd be interested in your comments.
Sure.
Do you want to take that, or should we have the other questions?
I don't mind.
If you don't mind. Well, okay, get our our two questions out.
Michael McDowell from the Panos Institute. Mine is quite different. I have a question about the Basque process and apples and oranges, and what is not an appropriate comparison and what is.
Okay. Well, first of all, for John's comments, I think a lot of this is a matter of perspective and depends upon where you stand. And I think in many respects, probably the international perspective is maybe a little bit more realistic in assessing and balanced in assessing what has actually occurred. And for me as well, I would agree with you that, I mean, a lot of the benefits from the agreement, the real benefits extend beyond the actual formal implementation of the specific aspects of that agreement. It is in the economy where Northern Ireland has seen a substantial amount of investment since the peace process began. It's had one of the faster rates of growth in the United Kingdom, though nowhere close to the levels of growth in the Republic of Ireland by comparison. The violence obviously has diminished. And also I think probably the biggest change is in terms of the sense of relationships within the wider islands context. I mean, relations between the British and Irish governments are now better than they've ever been in the history since the formation of the Irish state. And people are now moving freely across the island, not just nationals but unionists as well, and doing all types of business at a personal level. So a lot of the mood music in Ireland has changed. I think, though, for the people sort of living in Belfast and other parts of Northern Ireland, they don't really have the wider perspective that we can have sitting here in Washington over what's happened. I mean, it's almost like that drip feed process, and what they see is the events, particular events at a snapshot in time, and see politicians not delivering upon the expectations of the day in relation to devolved government, and that in turn creates a sense of cynicism. In terms of the parties having moderated, yes, you're right, both the DUP and Sinn Féin have moved to a large extent away from their historical positions. I mean, Sinn Féin have essentially bought into a partitionist settlement insofar as it goes at the moment. The irony of today is that Sinn Féin are the loudest voice for the immediate restoration of the Stormont Parliament, whereas it's unionists who are resisting that, which is a total reversal of the historical position. Yes, the DUP have bought into the institutions of the agreement, and they want changes to be made in terms of the detail, but in terms of the broad principles, yes, they're fine with that. What I would say, though, is that for me, the agreement was based upon building up through the centre and building up with the moderates being in control. But they expected to be in a position to bring in the extremes, but to co-opt the extremes and to control the extremes. They didn't expect the extremes to take over. And in that sense, Northern Ireland is more polarised today, because you have those parties who are on the fringes of the spectrum in the dominant position. And those parties with historical strength have seen their support collapse quite dramatically in recent years. And I think another way of looking at this is, around the world, whenever there is the momentum being built up towards a political agreement, you see the changes in the atmosphere between parties, the trust being built up between individuals at a personal level. We saw it in the talks leading up to the South African settlement, where some very important relationships on both sides were built up. As things stand at the moment, there are no real signs of emergence of that type of relationship emerging between DUP figures and Sinn Féin figures. They're both in a very standoffish position, and there's an expectation that a switch will be flicked, and all of a sudden they'll go from being in a position of antagonism to partners in government. And I have difficulty in seeing how that can actually take place. In terms of Michael's question about the comparison with the Basque region, I say that the big difference between Northern Ireland and the Basque country is that Northern Ireland is a divided society, where you have two main traditions who are relatively closely balanced in terms of numbers, whereas the Basque situation is more that of a region with a fairly dominant tradition in that region seeking autonomy from the Spanish state. So the political dynamics in that sense are very different. However, there are, I would say, parallels between the ETA ceasefire and the IRA ceasefire, and the way that the state will have to respond to those in terms of issues such as the decommissioning of weapons, verification that there is a genuine end to violence, how the issue of prisoners is going to be addressed, and also the concerns of victims and how they're going to react to the release of those prisoners.
Okay, great, thank you. We've got, let's take these three questions. First, we had Anatoly, Judy, and then this lady. Let's have the three of you together, and then Stephen will respond. Okay, so Anatoly.
Mm-hmm. At the mission USIP, in 1976, I accompanied Minister Gromyko. Maybe you remember this gentleman, to London. And he had talks with his British colleague, Callaghan. Mm-hmm. They liked each other. Mm-hmm. And at one certain moment, Callaghan said, "Nobody in Great Britain knows how to settle the Northern mm-hmm. Irish conflict. Mm-hmm. But who knows if the Soviet newspaper Pravda." And really, for many years, this conflict was a golden bottom for the Soviet propaganda. You understand the reasons. Then 25 years after, as a Russian ambassador to London, I certainly visited Northern Ireland. And besides the official meeting, we visited the estate of Lord Abercorn, yeah. whose wife by the way, is a distant relative of our great Pushkin. Mm-hmm. And they have their estate maybe 5 or 6 miles from the border. Yeah. And to my big surprise, I knew that during all the conflict, the border was open. And when I knew the figures of those who perished during this conflict for many years, and it couldn't be confronted with any other conflict in this world. So just for me, it may be difficult to call a conflict civilized. For me, I call this conflict a civilized one. And now I see that the agreement is civilized as well, because even the ambiguity is constructive in this agreement.
Yeah.
And certainly now we congratulate all the sides of VS Russia, congratulate all the sides for this agreement. And my question is not what will be the future of Northern Ireland, but what the local people, local Irish people or local American Irish people think about that. Because recently I saw an interesting stick on the bumper, Unite Ireland.
Yeah.
There are some cars with this stick.
Thank you. Let's have Judy next.
Judy Barclay, USIP. Thanks for a very interesting presentation. Northern Ireland presents us with some of the most vivid examples of memorialization efforts that that divide rather than unite. The annual marches, that are very provocative, the wall murals that commemorate martyrs and so forth. I'm under the impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there was a national commission or some body that was given authority to survey public opinion throughout Northern Ireland about how to remember and memorialize the conflict. Could you talk a little bit about where that is all headed? What efforts have been made or not to manage this memory process through memorialization?
Sure.
Carolyn Gallagher, American University. Two very brief questions. I wonder what you made of the UUP's decision to bring David Irvine into the voting at I guess it's Stormont.
Yeah.
And what you think it's going to take to decommission loyalist paramilitaries.
Okay. First of all, Anatoly, the success story of Northern Ireland in Russian terms is that probably Northern Ireland is the last Soviet republic left in Europe. Where the states controls over 60% of GDP, which has probably exceeded most Soviet republics at the height of communism. I think in terms of Northern Ireland being almost a civilized conflict, yes and no. I mean, in large extent, I mean, a lot of people were able to lead relatively normal lives during the course of the Troubles, and the violence was very compartmentalized. If you were a member of the security forces, or if you happened to live in a particular area close to a sectarian interface, then the risk was much, much greater, whereas other parts, the risk of dying in from a terrorist attack was a lot less. But everybody, in some shape or form, was caught up in the Troubles, or had relatives involved, or were affected by bomb scares and bombs going off. And while the level of death was maybe not as great as many other situations around the world, I think from everyone's internal perspective, it always matters, and people are looking for a solution. In terms of Irish America. Irish American has always been very pro United Ireland. I mean, the Irish American community is largely Catholic nationalist in origin. The Scots Irish emigrated from Northern Ireland and Scotland have been much more assimilated into American culture and don't see themselves as being part of that Irish diaspora. So the push in within America has historically been in one direction. However, the State Department historically, especially during the Cold War, took a very hands-off approach and deferred to the government of Britain in relation to Northern Ireland because of they were their close ally during the Cold War. In terms of Judy's point about memorialisation, there has been a number of efforts to try to look at the issue of trying to reach some common ground on memorials and also the wider issue of truth and reconciliation. There's been a number of people appointed to look at this question. The reports really haven't gotten anywhere because the issue of victims has really become so sectarianised. It's very difficult to see a common viewpoint coming out from all sections of the community as to a common way forward on this issue. Even within the past couple of years, the then British Secretary of State, Paul Murphy, was taking a very keen interest in what was happening in South Africa and led a major fact-finding mission over there. But whenever he came back, that initiative essentially ran aground and nothing further was taken on it. For me, I think trying to find some collective way of commemorating things, I think is going to be crucial, though I'm not sure how that's going to be achieved. One of the interesting things to look out for, from your perspective, is the former Mayor's Prison, or Long Kesh, as it was known by Republicans, is going to be redeveloped, mainly as a sports stadium, but in part is going to be a centre for conflict transformation, and one of the old H blocks where the hunger strikes took place is going to be kept as some type of museum to illustrate the conflict. How that is actually going to put across the many diverse explanations of what happened, I'm not entirely sure. That's one of the big questions that people are going to wrestle with over the next few months. But the gentleman to your right will fill you in, or to your left, will fill you in on more of what's happening on that. Sorry, and the issue of the Ulster Unionists, David Irvine link, I think they have made a huge tactical mistake in doing this, and it's going to bring them major problems at the ballot box at the next election. Where they've gone too far is, I think it's quite acceptable for political parties to talk to paramilitary organisations and their political representatives to try to reach an end to the violence. But in doing so, they need to draw a very careful distinction between themselves and who they're talking to. Whenever, for example, John Hume was talking, and I have very little time for John Hume, generally speaking, but whenever he did make his discussions with Gerry Adams over the IRA ceasefire, he was very careful to make the distinction that he was SDLP and Gerry Adams was Sinn Féin, and that the two were not going to merge, even though there was long-term political consequences for his party from those talks. But what the Ulster Unionists have done is essentially bring the Loyalists into their party without any assurances of an end to paramilitary activity. And the IMC, for example, have reported that they're still involved heavily in things like punishment beatings and shootings and organised crime, and without decommissioning their weapons. So every time there's a problem with the UVF, it's going to reverberate back onto the Ulster Unionists. And they're going to be asked questions as to how come you're endorsing this party so fully that you've taken them into your ranks, and where's your leverage? On the point of decommissioning, the UVF have made it clear that they have no intention of decommissioning, certainly not until November, to see how things unfold in the negotiations. We take that as essentially an implicit threat that if there is going to be any moves towards joint authority, in essence Britain and Ireland running Northern Ireland together in the event of talks failing, that there may be an armed reaction from Loyalist elements to that. So there's a sinister threat there from the UVF.
Thank you. Next on the list we have Ambassador Haider and then this gentleman over here.
I'm Salman Haider. I'm a fellow here at USIP. Thank you, Stephen, for the most lucid presentation. The Good Friday Agreement, as you know, has started a kind of minor international industry of study of the agreement to see how some of its features can be adapted and transplanted.
Sure.
Certainly, I, for one, I'm sure many others, had spent some hours trying to see the relevance of this process. And what has been striking is actually the procedures, the processes mm-hmm. whereby the agreement was arrived at, mm-hmm. and the fact that it succeeded in putting a halt to violence.
Yeah.
Now, the business as usual that you described, you know, the political business as usual, is less compelling, you know, for people who are not actually involved in it,
yeah.
and it's of course linked to the agreement, but perhaps not linked to the preoccupations of external sure. observers who are still grappling with mm-hmm. problems of violence.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is a couple of small questions. Is violence now over? Is there any chance of revival? Because some of the processes that you have described mm-hmm. show that the gap between political parties and those who have actually been involved in the agreement seems to be widening. Where mm-hmm. could that lead?
Mm-hmm.
And the loss of momentum, you know, the sort of clear projections that mm-hmm. came out from the Good Friday Agreement, more or less clear as to the expectations mm-hmm. at any rate. I mean, those have not been borne out by mm-hmm. events. But do we now expect a kind of indefinite maintenance of the status quo mm-hmm. or to
yeah.
or some other dramatic development
sure.
still attainable?
My name is Chris Murphy. I'm with International Educator Magazine. I have a couple of quick questions. The first one is with regard actually to the educational system in Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
I'd kind of like to get some comments from you with regard to the current state of the segregated system
mm-hmm.
and how you think that's affecting currently and potentially impacting in the long run attitudes within the society.
Yeah.
And then the second part, I guess, is with regard to the politics, with regard to the marginalization that you'd mentioned of the moderate parties. I'm curious about what you think about the perception that Trimble and Hume had going into the negotiations and whether they believed that they were marginalizing themselves at the time that they were doing it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, to my outside perspective, it looked to me like Hume had a very good picture of that and did think that he was going to marginalize himself, but Trimble may not have, or at
yeah.
least thought he could avoid it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. First of all, Salmon's questions. I think international focus is naturally going to fall more upon the actual agreement itself rather than implementation. And I think the more positive lessons of what have occurred lie in the approach that was taken to the Good Friday Agreement, where you had a very inclusive process that was sponsored by both the British and Irish governments and brought in George Mitchell, former US Senate Majority Leader, as the independent chair. That process worked very effectively, was seen as being very fair and transparent, and that the agreement itself was reasonably comprehensive in the issues that it addressed. Though, like all agreements, it only agreed what could be agreed at the time, and a number of issues were put off to be addressed later on during implementation. In terms of where we go from here, violence, I think, is at an end in the sense that terrorism is at an end. And by that I mean bombs going off against economic targets, the political assassinations, sectarian killings, attacks upon the security forces. I think that's now over from the Republican movement. And certainly the post 9/11 climate has helped that. And I think it's inconceivable now that the Republicans would return to that. Where the threat remains for both Republicans and Loyalists, and probably more with Loyalists at this stage, is in their involvement in organised crime. It's almost like a mafia situation is emerging in some parts of Northern Ireland. And also their desire to try to continue to control their own fiefdoms through the barrel of a gun or the bottom of a baseball bat. That's type of activity subverts the rule of law and is a danger. There's also a wider problem in that there sometimes can be major public order problems within Northern Ireland that arise over, for example, disputed parades, where you'll see lots of people coming out in the streets and engaging in rioting against the police. I mean, in some parts of Belfast, it's called recreational rioting. It's usual summer pastime, unfortunately. In terms of the political structures, I think it's certainly very much up in the air at the moment. I have to say I'm sceptical about whether a political deal can be reached between the DUP and Sinn Féin, and indeed the other parties. And if one isn't reached, I think Northern Ireland will stagger on in some shape or form. It certainly won't fall apart or go backwards. Largely because the British and Irish governments will step in and run things and provide a semblance of good governments, but beneath the surface, problems will persist. In terms of Chris's point, first of all, the education system, it's still very segregated. About 95% of children go to what are in effect Protestant or Catholic schools, and the system has arisen for a mix of historical reasons. The integrated sector is now 5-6% of the total. There are major problems facing education in Northern Ireland. There, with falling demographics, there's a huge oversupply of school space, and a lot of empty rooms and empty desks. And so there's a lot of pressure to rationalise the system in some shape or form. The only system that's really pushing in terms of growth is the integrated sector. But the difficulty is that the government tends to want to keep a lid on the problem of fragmentation in the system. Too often integrated education is seen as a further fragmentation of an already fragmented system rather than being a potential solution to those education problems. There's a very interesting review going to be conducted over the remainder of this year regarding the school estate, which may see some new changes in policy towards education. And the shared future document I referred to earlier has given a very clear steer towards asking for increased sharing in education. So even if you're not talking about formally integrated schools, trying to find ways in which Protestant and Catholic schools can actually collaborate, perhaps on the same campus. In terms of Trimble and Hume realising that they're going to be marginalised, I don't think either of them thought they would be marginalised. From the perspective of the Ulster Unionists, they went into the agreement actually not expecting Sinn Féin to say yes to things. I mean, one of the most remarkable things was decommissioning was a huge issue before the talks and during the first year of the talks. And after the talks, it dominated virtually all discussions. During the week leading up to Good Friday, decommissioning wasn't really an issue. It was left to Sinn Féin and the British government to work out the terms of the clause in the agreement. The Ulster Unionists spent their entire time worried about North-South structures, partially because the Irish government had put in a draft that was very green and which had to be unpicked, either through design or just the way things worked out. So Trimble spent his time trying to get that sorted out to avoid being perceived as falling into some all-Ireland agenda, that he wasn't really focused on the prospect of Sinn Féin coming in the government. And in fact, Sinn Féin said yes, and they wanted to enter the government. I'm not sure if Hume really appreciated that problem either. I mean, one of the unknown things is that Hume wasn't really a major player in the Good Friday Agreement negotiations. I mean, he was a very marginal figure, and most of the discussion was done by Seamus Mullen, his deputy, and people around him. Hume was a great man for the big speech and same speech on most occasions, he doesn't really have an ability to engage with a lot of the detail, and I mean he's lost a lot of his faculties in that respect over the past 10 years. That said, I think whenever he went into the Hume Adams dialogue, from his perspective, he would have said his bigger imperative was trying to find some degree of peace and bringing an end to our reactivity, and that was more important than the future of his party. I think there were elements of his party, I think he went a bit too far in terms of that. I think the wider, more specific structural problem was both the Ulster Unionists and the SDLP put in place the system of government that entrenched intra-ethnic competition and created a situation that was ripe for essentially ethnic entrepreneurs to exploit the situation and to criticise every move they made as being a sellout and to exploit the situation as a consequence.
Okay. So we've got two questions over here. Oh, and third. Okay. So let's start with you and you and then...
Mark Phillips, U.S. Agency for International Development. Assuming in the worst case scenario that the talks fail, do you think that after that occurs, an alternative to the Good Friday Agreement can be crafted that would be workable by both sides?
Margaret Smith, American University. Stephen, a number of us who are here were also present in March when you organized an event that focused particularly on the
sure.
shared future
yeah.
concept. And my understanding of what was being said that day, maybe by Duncan Morrow principally, mm-hmm. was that this was an idea that the Community Relations Council has mm-hmm. been pushing.
Yes.
It wasn't as clear how much the British government was really pushing it, and
yeah.
I was wondering whether you could say anything about that,
sure.
and also, apart from the integrated, or the school cooperation thing
yeah.
which you just mentioned, what are other specific ways in which the shared future idea is being tried to
sure.
push forward?
Okay.
Well, I sort of was going to ask, I was going to ask him, how are they presently integrating the schools,
mm-hmm.
and how are they integrating housing?
Sure.
Are they doing any of that? And then I wanted to know about the Catholic Protestant, the actual Catholic schools and Protestant schools, all the ministers and the priests. Are they cooperating? Do they want integration? Or do they want? Are they?
Mm-hmm.
What role is religion actually playing in either
sure.
in this shared future?
Okay. Okay, thanks. First of all, on the alternative to the Good Friday Agreement, I don't think there is an alternative to the agreement at a macro level, but there can be an alternative in terms of a lot of the details of how the agreement was going to be set up. I think the agreement is sound and it addresses all of the key questions. The nature of internal government within Northern Ireland, there has to be some type of power sharing. There has to be a north-south dimension, both to give expression to the national identity, but also to encourage social economic cooperation. There has to be an east-west British-Irish cooperation. You have to look at policing reform, human rights equality. All those aspects are there. It's the details, I think, that were got wrong and created problems that, as I've tried to show, undermine things. And if things fall apart in the autumn, whether it's 6 months, a year, or another generation until people come back to try to do things, they'll be looking at something that's fairly similar to the agreement in terms of the broad structures, but the specific ways in which things are done might be done differently. In terms of Margaret's point about shared future, certainly I think this is one of the most radical aspects of public policy that's come out of Northern Ireland in many years, and I think it's one where I think a lot of other societies may wish to look at what Northern Ireland has tried to achieve through this process. It has been pushed by a number of quarters, not least ourselves and the Alliance Party, but it's mainly been civil society driven. People like the Community Relations Council, the integrated education folks, and the political parties themselves haven't really embraced the idea. Whenever we had devolution, it wasn't really a priority for the devolved power-sharing executive. If anything, they couldn't agree on what to do, and the policy matter became stalled. It was only whenever the Assembly was suspended that the British government, on behalf of the local administration, started taking action. I'm not sure to what extent the government ministers coming in from London are that on board the process, though they say they are whenever I ask them. But within the civil service and other aspects of public agencies, there are a very strong number of people who are committed to this agenda, which is very encouraging. At a broad level, I mean, the fact that a lot of progress on community relations has actually occurred under direct rule as opposed to power sharing creates a real dilemma for those of us in the Liberal Centre as to the traditionally support power sharing but see a lot of the positive reform of social policy coming from direct rule, which in a sense clouds the reaction of civil society to the agreement. But specifically in terms of what else can be done apart from integrated education, and this also touches on the question about mixed housing, I think the housing issue is the one area that it really has to be attacked by government. And it is the most difficult one to address because people will be happy to mix with others in the workplace and even in schools or leisure facilities, but they like to have a sense of security in their own home. There will be a number of pilot schemes trying to promote mixed housing estates and trying to encourage people to live together. It's crucially important that the government supports that with security measures, because whenever this has been tried in the past, paramilitaries have tried to come in to take over the estate for either one or other side of the community, and has driven people out, and the state must protect any experiments very closely. The other interesting aspect is there's a lot of work going to be done on what is essentially the costs of division, what are the financial and economic implications from maintaining a divided society, and how does that hold Northern Ireland back? From my own estimations, probably about 10% of our economy is wasted on trying to provide duplicate services for different sections of society rather than quality services for everybody, and this is contributing to a large extent to the major fiscal crisis that's occurring in Northern Ireland at the moment. And finally, just to pick up the point about integrated schools, the integrated schools themselves, they amount to about 5% at the moment, and they would have a mixed governance. They're not secular schools in the American sense of public education, but they would try to teach diversity in education and cultures within those schools. But the churches haven't really been that supportive of integrated education in the past, certainly the Catholic Church puts a lot of importance upon the Catholic ethos for educating Catholic children, and they like to control their own schools and receive state funding for that. And they wouldn't see those schools as being part of the problem. They would see themselves as giving a rounded education to their children, and the same in the formal state sector, which is in effect Protestant. But the clergy would be actively involved in the boards of governors of both types of schools.
Okay, any final questions? Okay, we've got, looks like one more.
To what would you attribute the downturn in the voter turnout and the related absence of the civil society?
Yeah, I mean, a certain element of this is people who've always been alienated from Northern Ireland politics, historically, just never been involved. I think others have become very frustrated by the lack of political progress. And I mean, the irony of this is that it's those who would more likely vote for the moderate parties who are the first to opt out of the process and not to cast a vote because they're not as motivated as the voters who tend to go for the more extreme parties. So their actions tend then to magnify the switch of polarisation towards the extremes. Potentially, I think most of those moderates tend to be more on the Protestant side of the divide. Turnout in Catholic areas is a lot higher than in Protestant areas, those areas east of the ban. In part, that is, I think, also a reflection that a lot of elections, particularly in the western parts of Northern Ireland, tend to be essentially sectarian headcounts. Often the balance between the two sides tends to be very close. So there's a real imperative of people to turn out, to vote less the other side gets in and takes control. Whereas in the east, where it's more of a battle between unionist parties, the stakes in terms of whether it's unionist or nationalist aren't quite as acute. I think that there was hopes at the time of the agreement that there would be a lot of a new pro-agreement versus anti-agreement cleavage in society, but that hasn't emerged anything like the unionist-nationalist divide, which still dominates politics. If you look at also, we use a system of voting called single transferable vote, where people give preferences to politicians and are encouraged to vote across the communal divide. Most people still keep their first vote and all their subsequent votes within their tribal camp, and it's actually probably less than a quarter of voters on either side would be prepared to actually give any preference to a candidate from the other side of the divide. That's not to say there hasn't been some limited cases of tactical voting, where people have voted, Catholics have voting for either Protestant or vice versa, where it's very clear that the battle is really one between a hardline unionist and a moderate unionist, or a moderate nationalist and a extreme nationalist. Sometimes you will see people casting their votes tactically in that type of situation.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Stephen, very much for a great